Sorry for the late change of topic. I hope people are prepared for this. The title given in the Socialist Standard and initially on the party's website was Human Beings, Ultra-Social or Violent Predators? But when I came to preparing that topic, I realised that a talk I'd given very recently, in fact, last October, was something very similar. The title of that one was How Big an Obstacle Are Our Ideas About Human Nature to the Spread of Socialist Ideas? Now, obviously, some things bear repeating, but the two were similar enough to make me think that something new, or at least different, would be better. So I inquired if that was possible. It was permitted by the authorities, you know what I mean? And though it was obviously too late to change it in the standard, the title has been changed on the website. So, as I say, I hope this is what everyone was expecting. So, anyway, on to China then. The title, my title now is Xi Jinping's Regime, Socialism with Chinese Characteristics, or is it? What made me think of talking about this? Well, mainly two things. Firstly, a book I reviewed in the Socialist Standard not long ago, entitled The Communist Road to Capitalism, How Unrest and Containment Have Pushed China's Revolution / Evolution since 1949. And more recently, very recently, in fact, a conversation I had with someone who's recently been to China and spent some time there. I'll start by talking about the second thing first, that is the person who was recently in China. So something to start with, anecdotal, if you like. The person I had that conversation with was a social scientist who lectures and researches at a university, one I'm still connected with. One of my connections is that I do voluntary work there for the Lecturers' Union, the UCU, and this consists mainly of assisting members with employment issues, which they may have, personal cases, we call them. This particular union member, the social scientist, Daniel is his name, came to see me because he was dissatisfied with his treatment by his academic department, and he explained to me why. But I'm not going to talk about that, obviously. I'm going to focus on something he mentioned to me as a prelude to his employment complaint. He told me that he recently spent a period of study leave in China with his wife, who is also an academic at the same university here, and who is herself actually Chinese. He mentioned that he also had spent significant periods in China in the past, and that during his recent stay, both he and his wife were offered jobs at the university in the city where he was based, and they'd considered accepting these jobs and so leaving their employment here in the UK. But on reflection, he told me they decided not to. Why? Because, and these were his words, because of the dire situation in China. So dire was the specific word that he used. Anyway, after we'd had a conversation about his current employment situation and mapped out a possible way forward, before we parted company, I told him I was interested in what he'd said about China and what did he mean about the situation there being dire. Well, he was happy to talk, and what he proceeded to tell me was the following. He said there had been three main reasons for his calling the situation in China dire. The first one had been a particular concern to his wife, and this was a noticeable perceived increase in what he called misogyny in China. What was that about? Well, he explained that China's one-child policy, having been abandoned quite some time ago, about 10 years ago, the government was now concerned that partly as a result of the conditioning that policy had engendered, the population wasn't replacing itself. And so they were now putting considerable pressure on women to have more children and on the need for them to stay at home rather than be in employment. So insisting on being employed was being portrayed as some kind of betrayal of the nation by women. So although, as I said, they both ended up being offered jobs in China, his wife was sufficiently concerned by what she saw and heard and about how that might affect her. This is one of the reasons they decided not to stay there. The second thing he said was that it was clear to them that since they were last there, things had become noticeably more repressive. This manifested itself, for example, by the way, he'd worked there as well, apart from visiting, he'd actually been employed there for a period in the past. But he said this increased repression manifested itself, for example, in university employees, academics that is, having to seek special permission simply if they wanted to spend a weekend away in another city or another part of the country. And also in it having become more difficult to get colleagues they knew to speak openly about any subject that might be considered sensitive or political. The third thing was that it was increasingly difficult for foreigners to obtain visas to stay or to continue residence there. And one result, for example, he said, was that a good number of Western media correspondents had not had their visas renewed recently. In fact, he told me that the China correspondent of The Economist, who he knew personally, told him she feared that when her visa came up for renewal, it was likely it would be refused and she would have to leave the country. At the same time, he also mentioned that there'd been a noticeable deterioration in economic conditions, with signs that the government seemed nervous about possible unrest or protest. And his personal view was that the fuss it was making over Taiwan, something we've probably all heard about, was largely a way of trying to distract attention from deteriorating prospects and living conditions. In fact, he ended up wondering, slightly tongue-in-cheek, obviously, whether, given the repressive atmosphere, a comparison with the Ming dynasty might not be appropriate. Now, I said this was anecdotal, and it is, but it is evidence. It's evidence of the type that social scientists call qualitative. So I don't think it should just be ignored, especially if it's backed up by other sources. And it actually does seem to be. Just one of those for the moment, on the population front, to do with the situation of women. Just last week, a report on the BBC News website pointed out that China's population has shrunk for 2 years in a row and that the government has expressed concern about the low birth rate, leading potentially to a loss of young workers and a quickly aging population, and about how this would affect the economy in an ongoing way. According to this report, it appears that young people are increasingly reluctant to get married and have children. And according to official data, the number of registered marriages has been declining for 9 consecutive years. Last year alone, it dropped by at least 500,000. The report went on to say that in October of last year, President Xi said that women played, I quote, this is a quote from the great leader, from the president, women play a unique role in promoting traditional virtues, and there is a need to cultivate a new marriage and childbearing culture to tackle the aging population. And in a speech in November, so a very short time ago, he called for government officials to promote, again, I quote, a marriage and childbearing culture and to influence young people's thinkings on love and marriage, fertility and family. A report on this from abroad has called this Xi's war on women. I stress that this is a report from abroad, since there's no doubt that it would have been pretty dangerous to say such a thing at home. So that's one area. But before widening it, I want to go on to the book I mentioned earlier, The Communist Road to Capitalism, written in 2021, so pretty recent, and its author is an American, Ralph Ruckus. Now, that title is a bit of a teaser, The Communist Road to Capitalism, but I'll try and explain. Its explicit thesis is that starting in 1949 and throughout the rule of Mao, China was a communist or socialist society. He uses both words pretty interchangeably. But he says it later shifted to being capitalist, which it is now. This shift, according to Ruckus, began to take place from 1978 onwards, so not long after the death of Mao. And it finally led to what he sees as a now firmly established form of capitalism, overseen today by the Xi Jinping regime. Now, obviously, we take issue with his characterization of China as communist or socialist under Mao. And we'd say that while China today certainly is capitalist, largely state capitalist, so it has been ever since the Maoist takeover of the country in 1949. And for that regime to call itself socialist or communist was simply rhetoric. And we'd go on to say that all that has changed since Mao's time is the way Chinese capitalism has been managed by its rulers, and in particular, its permission for a certain degree of private capitalism to develop, and also its increasing integration into the world capitalist market. So Mao had closed off China's economy to the world, then his successors began to throw it open. In 2001, for example, China joined the World Trade Organization, and along the southeast coast of China, new cities came into being with individual entrepreneurs and traders, often specializing very narrowly in specific products, often as banal as buttons or zips or socks, often producing tens of billions of them. More recently, in terms of change, China instituted its so-called Belt and Road Initiative, aimed at extending its economic and political reach and influence to as many parts of the world as possible, and actually finding fertile ground in other Far Eastern countries, but also in countries like India, in Africa, South America, and even some European countries. All this produced high rates of economic growth, a definite alleviation of extreme poverty, no doubt about that, and in fact has made it the world's second biggest economy, and also the biggest export nation in the world. And as we'll all have noticed, a huge manufacturer of very many familiar products considered essential in modern times. I don't have to sort of list them, but ones often considered innovative too, such as electric vehicles, batteries, AI, and other advanced technologies. And it's this post-Mao development and its effects on the country and its people that Ruckus focuses on in his book. And he does this in a way that's of definite interest to socialists. His focus is mainly on two things. Firstly, the countless changes of policy and practice which China's rulers, post-Mao, have practiced in their efforts to somehow integrate state capitalism with private ownership of capital. And also in that process, the struggles these rulers have had both with one another and with the Chinese people. Secondly, we're given an intimate view by Ruckus of the pretty harsh experience of life for most people in China, workers and peasants alike during this period, even if it's been nothing like as bad as it was under Mao. And those twists and turns and changes in policy and practice I've mentioned as characterizing post-Mao China are still continuing. And the truly interesting question, which Ruckus also tries to address, is where will that go? And where does it tie in, if it does, with that scenario outlined by Daniel, my union member, who was a recent first-hand witness to this? Well, before trying to answer that, let me go back first to the title of this talk, which asks whether present-day China under the leadership, authoritarian as it is, of Xi Jinping is, I quote, socialism with Chinese characteristics. This is the term perpetually used by official regime propaganda, and in fact by many other sources, as I'll explain in a moment, to describe modern China. I recently received a pre-publication copy of a book whose subtitle is Centennial Reflection on China's Revolutionary Road. Doesn't seem to be explained how they got centennial. I don't know what it's 100 years since, but the book, although not a Chinese government propaganda publication as such, is actually published by Routledge, an arm of the biggest academic publisher in the world, Taylor and Francis. It's clearly written by somebody who's a keen supporter of the regime, somebody called Wei Xiaowei, and who riddles it with references to socialism with Chinese characteristics. I'll just read one short passage in the reference which reads as follows. Sorry, in the 1970s, under the leadership of Deng Xiaoping, China shifted towards a more market-oriented economy while maintaining its socialist ideology. This socialism with Chinese characteristics approach allowed China to modernize its economy and become a major world power. Today, the country continues to apply Marxist principles and promote socialist values in both ideology and governance. President Xi Jinping has played a significant role in advancing the concept of, I'll call it SCC, because it's become an acronym, so socialism with Chinese characteristics, and implementing it in practice. And it goes on to talk about Xi's thought on SCC as being applicable to the whole of humanity and being committed to the liberation of all mankind. And finally, I quote, it transcends and empowers human wisdom to the utmost degree. Wow, okay. Now, of course, it goes without saying that socialism with Chinese characteristics is an expression whose meaning is so fraught with ambiguity that it can be twisted to mean just about anything. And the same thing applies to the other oft-repeated official phrase of the Chinese leadership to describe China, which is the harmonious socialist society. Yet, this socialism with Chinese characteristics description is something that also seems to have been taken seriously by a fair number of others outside China, in particular left-wing Western commentators, especially academics. Prime example of this is Richard Wolff. Sure some of you have heard of him, the much-published American economist, and he's prone to praising China to the skies. He recently wrote a piece on a website called Friends of Socialist China, entitled The Fatal Contradictions of China Bashing. And just last week, I attended a webinar myself on what was called eco-socialism, addressed by another eminent American academic, John Bellamy Foster, sociology professor and author of a number of books on Marx, particularly on Marx's take on ecology. He's also editor of the widely circulated left-wing journal Monthly Review. When he was asked a question about China during the webinar, Bellamy Foster quite merrily described what you had there as, wait for it, socialism with Chinese characteristics. So he swallowed it too. Others on the left aren't averse to calling it something a bit different, market socialism or a socialist market economy, things we would, of course, regard as a contradiction in terms. And just last year, June 2023, a British-based commentator called Carlos Martinez, who writes for the Morning Star, published a book entitled The East is Red, Chinese Socialism in the 21st Century. Now, have these people read Ruckus? Would they want to? Probably not. But in any case, they seem not to want to know about what Ruckus sees as increasingly autocratic, authoritarian rule with enhanced repression, and what at one point Ruckus calls the criminalization of open disagreement and discontent. all of which actually sounds very much like what's happening in Russia at the moment. But so is this what is meant by socialism with Chinese characteristics? Judge for yourself, but this take does seem to tie in very closely with what Daniel, my university union member, told me just last week. However, to move forward a little bit now, there's also a strain of optimism present in Ruckus's analysis, because while referring to the regime's, I quote, astonishing ability to deal with social and political unrest while retaining a certain level of popular support, at the same time, he seems to think that the regime will actually find it difficult in the longer term to contain social unrest. And this is likely to lead to more enlightened government policies, or at least a relaxation of repression. And he actually draws a parallel with the late 1980s about Eastern Europe, about which he says, we have seen other seemingly stable regimes crumble. Yet, though you never can tell, this seems unlikely to happen very soon. Many people in the West thought serious change was coming as far back as 1989, but the Tiananmen Square massacre put a stop to that, and if anything, shifted China backwards in the authoritarian stakes. So what is happening in this year, if anything, in this year of the dragon, actually, what is happening that might point towards any kind of change in the direction of more democracy or at least reduced authoritarianism? Well, what might point towards that, even if it seems paradoxical, is that China's economic growth is slowing down quite considerably. And part of this, at least, seems to be due to the extremely tight control the government is exercising over the productive process. After the end of the Mao era, despite the restraints inevitable in production that's tightly monitored by the state and corruption in all sorts of areas, I won't go into that now, despite that, China massively expanded its economy, opened it up, and integrated it into the world capitalist market, as I mentioned earlier. And this did bring about a significant increase in living standards for many Chinese workers and peasants. Admittedly, this was from a very low base and also at the expense of massive upheavals in people's lives and ways of making a living. But the ability of capitalism to develop the forces of production to a point where there could potentially be plenty for all, only if that plenty, of course, we would say is produced and distributed for need rather than for profit, it's something that that Marx recognized in the 19th century and has been borne out by the development of capitalism ever since. That development within capitalism has not, of course, led to plenty for all and economic equality, but it has tended to be accompanied by political democratization to help generate, or which certainly has helped generate, the free expression and exchange of ideas and invention necessary, we've always argued, for capitalist economic development to proceed. And as I say, this is an argument the party has often put, and has in most cases seemed to be correct. I mean, one example, and there are many others, is the fall of the Soviet Union and the relative liberalization of Russia under the pressure of developing capitalism, in spite, of course, of the apparent backward steps Russia has taken in recent times. So will China's anti-democratic, socially repressive, one-party form of government eventually bump up against and be shown to be incompatible with the needs of capitalist production? In that context, as the last part of this talk, just a brief survey to try and see, gleaned from various sources, what seems to be happening in China at this very moment in social and economic terms. And again, this does seem to complement, and I would say to a large extent, to confirm the observations of Daniel, the union member I've mentioned a couple of times already. First of all, on the level of economic organization and the productive forces, state ownership is still, in a very important sense, the norm. And so-called SOEs, state-owned enterprises, continue to dominate what can be called the commanding heights of the Chinese economy. They contribute a significant percentage to China's GDP, with more than 1,000 of these SOEs listed on China's stock market and accounting for 44% of total market listings. Despite this, however, as mentioned earlier, there has been permission for wide private enterprise and production. And we all know this from many of the goods we order or buy here in this country every day. But the state continues to keep a close eye on private ownership and sometimes intervenes in it. Someone has written, state-owned versus private is not a clear distinction within Chinese companies. That's an interesting observation. At the same time, a small section of the population has been allowed to amass vast personal wealth, while the vast majority own nothing but their labor power, a bit like here, in fact, in that respect. For example, in 2021, The Economist, referring to Forbes, the American publication Forbes, reported that China, including Hong Kong and Macau, had 698 dollar billionaires, almost as many as America, which had 724. It didn't mention how many simple millionaires, but it's certainly many thousands. Yet the state, as I've already suggested, also attempts to regiment the market, sometimes for political reasons, with party bureaucrats and corporate billionaires sitting in boardrooms together, and often a sort of blurring of the line between bureaucratic state capital and private corporate capital. Yet, however it's organized, after decades of economic growth, there's no doubt that the Chinese economy is now losing a certain momentum. The property market, for example, is reported as suffering a downturn. And very much like here, there's mounting local government debt. Also, the balance between state ownership and private enterprise is causing problems. And Chinese private investors, of whom, as I've said, there are now many, are worried that Xi Jinping's leadership will put party control above economic development. An article in The Economist just a couple of weeks ago is entitled "China's Well-to-Do Are Under Assault from Every Side. Their agonies at the hands of the markets, the hands of markets and the state will reshape the Chinese economy." Superlative perhaps that, but you can see the point it's making. And there've been very recent crackdowns on private enterprises. For example, private tutoring, which was a huge private industry, has been more or less taken under state control. And regulation over big tech has, according to Reuters, wiped more than $1 trillion off its value. And as I've just said, there's been a big property downturn. Early this month, Chinese stocks plunged into a five-year low, leading to much online criticism of the current leadership, although the posts were quickly taken down, predictably. The party seems to want to make life more uncomfortable for private firms, especially in the technology and digital sector, and to police more closely the way they're managed. So that's something from what you might call the capitalist side, be it state or private investors. What about the workers' side? Well, first of all, there's significant unemployment. Official data released in June 2023 showed increasing youth unemployment, with more than one in five city dwellers aged between 16 and 24 being unemployed. After this, the government suspended the release of youth unemployment data for 6 months. But in January this year, it did release a figure, and that figure was 14.9%. rather than 20% as it was 6 months earlier. So a bit of a reduction, but the data excluded students, and who knows whether it was accurate or not, especially as another source says it's still 20%. Now, this is probably an effect of the relative stalling of economic growth, partly at least due to weaker global demand. And with the growth rate, China's growth rate, according to one source, running at 3% after being at least double that for many years. Not clear if that 3% is absolutely accurate. However, the International Monetary Fund gives slightly different figures and mentions 4.5% growth in 2023. Elsewhere, I've actually seen 5.2%, but any of these figures are still a drop on previous years. And the widely forecasted, certainly the International Monetary Fund forecasts a continuation of what it calls sluggish growth in the period from 2025 to 2028. One of the impacts of this is that Chinese manufacturers in various industries, such as electronics and garment manufacturing, have had lower earnings because of that weaker global demand. And this has caused many factories to close or production to be mothballed. And that's usually happened, it appears, without staff receiving severance pay or anything else. And those businesses that remain open are known to be experiencing difficulties meeting their regular wage bills. Chinese websites and social media accounts have posted complaints of layoffs and stagnant or falling wages. And on the back of this, there appears to be evidence, though it's obviously hard to corroborate, of protests and strikes in China's manufacturing center. It appears that in the first half of 2023, there was an increasing number of small-scale incidents of worker unrest across China's coastal industrial hubs in the Pearl River and the Yangtze River deltas, where China's workforce of rural migrant labor, workers who've come from the countryside, where they are concentrated. And the Hong Kong-based rights group, China Labor Bulletin, recorded 140 strikes across China from January to May 2023, and close to 2,000 among strikes and demonstrations over the whole year. It reports that just over a year ago, protesters clashed with police at the world's biggest iPhone factory in Zhengzhou, with workers angry with Foxconn for going back on promises to increase pay and benefits to attract workers back after the pandemic. This report from China Labor Bulletin goes on to suggest that all this could translate into persistent wage-related unrest and increased pressure on the regime for an overhaul in the country's economic model and better social protection for workers. A better welfare system is what it's talking about. And this applies particularly, it emphasizes, to China's huge so-called platform economy. The deteriorating economy and the prospect of social upheaval, is the Chinese bureaucracy, in the form of the Chinese Communist Party, seeking, perhaps over desperately, to consolidate its forces around the figure of Xi by using hardcore repression? Okay. Almost finished now. Time will tell. Will this, what as somebody has called market-frenzied country, which is pretty much as undemocratic as and hierarchical as a country can be, okay, maybe not as bad as North Korea, yeah, that's reasonable, can it become more democratic and open in the way it's governed? Will it be able to shed its current illiberal form of government, which in the longer term can only stand in the way of its continuing capitalist development? And it's something that we would see as also standing in the way of socialist consciousness developing subsequently. Whatever the case, on the question of socialism with Chinese characteristics, we can only agree with what the American academic Rebecca Carl, a prolific writer on China, has said about this notion. She's written, I quote, "China today has no socialist characteristics. The subordination of labor to capital is complete. If you're a real socialist, you must have a notion of class democracy, of justice, of hierarchy and anti-hierarchy. None of that is even part of Xi Jinping's thought. And somebody else has written, again, I quote, China is capitalist. It's capitalist both because it is fully integrated in the global capitalist system and because capitalist imperatives have penetrated all the way down to everyday life. And we'd have to agree with that too. So despite labels that might be attached to it, China is obviously not socialist or communist, or as things stand, even remotely in its current situation, on the road to that genuine alternative system of society beyond the system of wages, money and profit, the one that we in the Socialist Party would call socialism. That's it. Thanks for listening.